Launch all sequence has started.
Crew one for all.
Welcome to Moon Snacks, the show where we record our favorite leaders and we're going to send them to the moon.
We have Professor Donald McLean who will be talking with us. He's a strategist and he's written books in terms of strategic management.
Absolutely. And we get to spend this time with someone who has such a kind of diverse history, started engineering, went into strategies, done a lot of research, and then we get to send him to the moon. Well, we did decide, I think this is probably pretty clear, we need someone good with strategy, the why we're doing what we're doing. So this is why we've brought Donald in.
Strategy and purpose. And my understanding is he does a lot of work also around the use of story.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi. So Donald, please meet Ed. Really nice to have you on, Donald.
Hi, Ed.
Lovely to meet you, Donald.
You know, before we dive in and send you to the moon, though, Donald, I feel like I'm in a doctor sandwich. Am I calling you Dr. Donald and Dr. Ed today?
Please just call me Donald.
Yeah, you always call me Ed, I think. I could change. Do you want me to get rid of the Dr.
No,
Ed?
No, I just think it's great I have two doctors in the room, especially because we need more of those on the moon. So
I'm actually a doctor of optoelectronics. I was working in a research lab and somebody said to me in this lab, if you've not got a PhD, everybody assumes you're really stupid till you prove that you're clever. And if you've got one, everybody assumes that you're really clever till you prove yourself stupid. So I thought, all right, I'll get one.
Well, how did you transition from that to what you're doing now?
Unless you're dealing with something weird like quantum mechanics, which I was on the edge of, it's like this, Donald, in engineering land at that time seemed to me to be, it was kind of quasi-deterministic. So at one point I thought, this isn't interesting anymore. I'm getting a bit bored with it. Why am I doing it? And so I get really interested in the why. And so when you get into the why, I get into the idea of communications and the economics, if you like, of all the technology that was being deployed to help people chat to one another.
Although we like you a lot, we are going to send you to the moon. We think your skills are vital there as we kind of populate the place with our favorite people. And along the way, you get three movies to take with you. So we are going to dive into your first film. I just want to get into a little bit of, first, how are you going to spend your time on the moon? You're someone who's insatiably curious, who is self-aware and understands that kind of the emotions is what connects everything together. It's what connects knowledge together. It's what connects people and relationships and experiences together. What do you think the first thing you're going to do on the moon is? Are you going to start research? Do you want to build something?
So I am definitely not going to start research. I'm absolutely pathetic at DIY, so I definitely wouldn't try and build anything because it wouldn't last. I have got absolutely no doubt what I would do, actually. And that is, I would stand transfixed looking at planet Earth. The great mythologist Joseph Campbell was interviewed towards the end of his life. And I remember the interview and saying to him, is there anything in the 20th century that will join the great stories of mankind? And he turned it back on the interviewer and said, well, what do you think? And the guy said, the Great War, or the invention of the transistor or something like that. And he said, no. No, it's this story where three guys get themselves into a tin can and launch themselves at the moon. It's got all the classic things in a big story. Will they make it? Won't they make it? Can you even stand on the moon? You know, is it real? It's all been theory till now. Will it work? Won't it work? It's a brilliant story. And then the guy said to him, okay, so big stories have got a message. What is the message? And Joseph Campbell said, well, it's this. And as far as I'm terrible for making up things. So I think what I saw in the interview is he pulled out a picture of the planet Earth and said, this is it. And he said, this is a big story and the only story of the 20th century, really, because it's the first time a human being has seen or photographed this thing as a unity. And he then said, so what does that mean? And he said, well, don't you notice anything about it? And the interviewer said, it's beautiful. And he said, no. And he said, what then? And he said, well, there aren't any lines on it. every time you've seen this, there have been lines on it. And I think this is our people. This is in the 1980s. If we think what's happening now, he said, I think this is our people wakening up to the fact that the lines we're drawing in this thing are killing it.
It is a big story. See, I love picturing you on the moon looking back at Earth pondering that. I think that is really wonderful. So when you're done staring at Earth, we are giving you three movies because we're not monsters just leaving you on the moon without anything to do. So The Dead is... Who directed The Dead? That was John...
John Huston.
One by one, we're all becoming shades. How long you locked away in your heart the image of your lover's eyes when he told you that he did not wish to live. I've never felt that way myself towards any woman. But I know that such a feeling must be love.
So I am not a film buff, by the way. I don't go into all the technicalities of it, but it was John Huston. As far as I understand, it was the last film that he made before he stopped making films. And he deliberately held this to the end because he was in awe of James Joyce and wanted to finish off his life with a tribute to one of his heroes.
Yeah, he was so ill, Donald, that he, first of all, he had his children working with him. Angelica was his daughter, and Tony was was his son, I guess, doing some of the screenwriting. But he was in a wheelchair for the duration of most of that, receiving oxygen for his emphysema. And he finished the movie about April, and he died in August. So this was his closing piece. But it's an amazing... the background to that whole movie is really fascinating, that he would choose that as his reason for why to do a final movie.
And I think that's the fundamental thing that strikes me about it. It's almost an act of worship. You know, it's an absolutely beautifully sensitive study of human beings at their most ordinary.
You said the last scene gets you every time.
To put that into context, the only other films where the last scene usually gets me is something like Lassie. I'm actually quite hard when I'm watching films. But I cannot watch the last scene of The Dead without tears rolling down my cheeks. It's utterly sublime. And it's partly down to the beautiful lyricism of James Joyce, partly down to things that I've got no clue why with me they chime, and partly down to, I think, the thing that comes through the whole film for me personally more than anything is the power of the human voice. So it's the way it's said at the end. I've actually got some of the words here. So you know the film, there's this story of a middle-class gathering in Dublin at Christmas time, I think, or the festive season, certainly, and blah, blah, blah. And then at the end of it, there's this incredible revelation that happens between the main character and his wife. And he then goes into some very reflective, it's quite a big revelation about a love that she had when she was a young girl. And he's thrown into some really reflective stance. And then these words come up. Please, if you want to cry, cry, but you might just laugh at me. I don't know why they get me. The time had come for him to set out on his journey westwards. Yes, the newspapers were right. Snow... It's getting me now. Snow was general all over Ireland. It was falling in every part of the dark central plain, on the treeless hills, falling softly upon the Bog of Allen and farther westward, slowly falling into the dark, mutinous Shannon waves. It was falling too upon every part of the lonely churchyard on the hill where Michael Fury lay buried. It lay thickly drifted on the crooked crosses and headstones, on the spears of the little gate, on the barren thorns.
Aren't you going to be sad watching that on the moon on your own, or is it going to make you feel more connected with Earth?
I don't know. I think is the honest answer. Aldous Huxley has got a term that he uses. I think he says transported. When I get moved by something like that, it's a very internal kind of thing that in some senses I'm not connected to anything, and in other ways I'm connected to absolutely everything.
Is this something you watch regularly, once in a while? Is it something that you make your friends watch? Did you see it in the cinema? What's your relationship with this movie?
To be totally honest, I usually watch it when my family are out doing something more interesting for them. And I think, brilliant, I've got a couple of hours, I can watch what I want. I tend to watch it on my own now. I have shared it with a few friends, and the reaction has been at worst underwhelming and at best polite.
Okay. You haven't found another kindred spirit that feels the same way?
No.
It's a subtle movie. And this is a movie that changes colors for me when you watched it. So when it first came out, I was finishing up my studies at Columbia, was starting at NASA, and I was in my 20s. And I love the beauty of it. And, you know, I love cinematography and the imagery and James Joyce. The first time I saw it, I said, oh, this is kind of depressing. This is kind of a European depressing, kind of a little bit too much for this Brooklyn boy. But then the more, and I've watched this many times, the more I've watched it, the more I loved it, because the message here is you better live your life, because we're all getting to that point where the snow is going to be coming down. And watch them. So I love this movie. I think it's so powerful, and it grows with you. And I don't know why. I'd love to ask one question, John Huston. Why did you save it for the end? I think I know. I think this was his homage to Ireland, having lived there, and James Joyce. But also, I think this is his message to himself, to his children, to keep dreaming.
I like to think, Ed, that in addition to what you've said, he also wanted to do it towards the end because it would be the beneficiary of everything he had learned. In some senses, and, you know, that is an incredible tribute to pay to James Joyce. The other thing I loved about it, there's a poem about halfway through it called Donal Og, which is an Irish Gaelic poem translated into English, and it's recited absolutely mesmerisingly by the actor who recites. It's just absolutely stunning. It's easily my favourite poem, and it harkens back to an era in Celtic, Gaelic, Irish Gaelic, Scots Gaelic culture where poetry was mystical and powerful. It wasn't just a form of entertainment. That poem's absolutely amazing.
What I love about what you're saying, I hadn't thought about it, Donald, you just said this, is I've always loved music, I've loved story. And this movie really is about those things, because what sets off a lot of the thinking and the feeling is the story.
What you've just said there, Ed, the power of story. So in my world, which is all about strategy, people tend to think of strategy as some kind of plan. And usually it's promulgated through weird devices like PowerPoint and Excel spreadsheets and all that kind of thing. It's quite difficult for people to get their head around how recent an invention that is. And certainly in this part of the world where I am just now, in the Scottish Highlands and Islands, until maybe 200-300 years ago, social order was promulgated through poetry and song, not through PowerPoint or plans or that kind of thing. And you think, well, why was that? And it's because of what you've just said, Ed. It's because it strikes you. It makes you want to be part of it. It brings you in a way that no amount of email, presentation, anything like that can ever do. And that too is one of the kind of, that's one of the fundamental ideas behind strategy story, in a way we are trying to reinstitute some of our own traditions, which are to bring people together through story and aspiration and all that kind of thing. It's so powerful. And the human voice, I promise I'll shut up in a minute. One of the big distinctions in strategy is between the kind of planned, deliberate, write it all down, then execute version on the one hand, it's kind of formal strategy, and then the other version of it is emergent strategy, which is one that just kind of happens as you go along and it's brought together into some kind of shape. Now, we are very much towards the latter, the emergent one, but the thing about emergent strategy is it isn't written down usually, it's spoken. And so when people say oral culture's dead, they're wrong. It's alive. It's just that in organisations we think it's not legitimate, it's gossip or something like that, but it's actually the only thing that's really happening.
Coming from NASA, when we were quiet, when we didn't say things, that's what led to the failures. When people have voice, when they're given permission to tell their story, to sing their song, that leads to, I think, the successes, you know, that we have. And I think that's also the power of movies, is movies, look what the dead has led to in this discussion. The power that, but the importance of humans to be heard.
James Lapine in Into the Woods has a great line where, "Careful the tale you tell, that is the spell." Which is true, because words can be like spells, and in most cultures, stories are considered medicine.
Snow is falling, falling faintly through the universe, and faintly falling.
Which leads me to your second. So what is your second film?
It is Lord of the Rings, the trilogy.
It began with the forging of the Great Rings. Three were given to the elves, immortal, wisest, and fairest of all beings. Seven to the dwarf lords, great miners and craftsmen of the mountain halls. And nine rings were gifted to the race of men who, above all else, desire power. For within these rings was bound the strength and will to govern each race. But they were all of them deceived, for another ring was made. In the land of Mordor, in the fires of Mount Doom, the Dark Lord Sauron forged in secret a master ring to control all others. And into this ring he poured his cruelty, his malice, and his will to dominate all life. One ring to rule them all.
Do you get the whole trilogy? Are we going to give him the whole trilogy?
Yeah,
are we being
absolutely.
That nice? Okay, we'll give you the whole
trilogy.
You
have to give him the whole trilogy, yeah.
Okay, so you're getting more bang for your buck, but we'll allow it. So tell us a little bit about, you saw this in the cinema, I'm assuming.
I did see it in the cinema, but having grown up with it as a boy, you know, reading the books, and I had an interesting childhood in a lot of ways. If there was ever a need to escape, then I would escape into the magical landscape that Tolkien had created, and I was utterly fascinated by the even as a boy, I read that he had first of all created the language and then developed the landscape around the language. You know, it's almost a biblical kind of idea. That it's just incredible how he put this incredibly complex world together. And I used to lose myself in it, and I could wander around in it completely separate from the story and see things that aren't in the plot line.
Because we are story junkies, can you paint us a picture or tell us a little bit of a story about you as a kid, your childhood? Where take us to a place. Where are we? And how old were you when you first came across these stories?
Well, when I was in primary school, so this is in the village of Rue on the west coast of Scotland. It's about an hour out of Glasgow to the northwest. It's a lovely little village. It's probably grown now since I live much further north now, but I can remember that I had moved there with my family, and the teacher, I found the move a bit tricky, you know, and the teacher, Mrs. Trippick, I will never forget her name.
Well done.
Used to read to us lots of stories, but she particularly read The Hobbit, and I was absolutely captivated by that. So she read it in the right order. I was a bit disappointed with the films when they came out in the money-making order. But she read that, and that kind of got me. And then so as soon as Lord of the Rings became available as a paperback, I got a copy. I might even have got it out of the library. I can't remember. And, I just read it and read it and read it and read it more than once and talked about it with some friends because, you know, we were all a bit geeky, yeah.
Was there one character in particular that spoke to you?
The one that mystified me most and kind of intrigued me was the character Aragorn. I thought he was brilliantly portrayed in the film, but he was much more kind of worldly and human than I had expected when I read the book. He was a slightly more fringe and mysterious phenomenon in my imagination.
And you love those movies too, don't
you? Oh, yeah. They're brilliant. I love them. As a person who works in organizations, one of the questions that I usually get into is what gets people motivated? what gets people committed to doing something, what makes a good team great. And I use often the story about imagine the Lord of the Rings, whether you're a hobbit or an elf or a human, and you basically are coming together, you don't kind of like each other that much. What's going to make you take on a mission where you're basically told you have to take this ring, you have to go across the world and drop this in a dangerous volcano, and you're going to be fighting dragons and spiders. You're basically going to be doing things where the normal person would say, I'm not going to do this. And I think that, to me, Lord of the Rings is about if the story is meaningful enough to us, and if it connects with us so that we know where we're going, why we're going there, and the importance of it, then we'll do all kinds of things because we believe in that kind of vision. And to me, Lord of the Rings, if you look at it just, if you take it apart without the emotional aspect of it, it becomes kind of ridiculous. But when you put in the humans and the elves and their feelings and their connections and their loyalties and their families and all these things that make a story very powerful, it then makes total sense of why they're doing these things, why they're fighting, and why they're, you know, comfortable to likely die for something. And so to me, The Lord of the Rings is just that example of the power of the purpose, the power of the vision, the power of someplace that's better, and the importance of doing it with others who you care for.
You know, the power of story to draw folk in to a purpose that in many ways is beyond them, which is, in actual fact, what strategy is meant to be about in a lot of situations, and leadership is meant to be about. It's about trying to get people to do things together that is a real stretch and sometimes quite risky. And Lord of the Rings is a phenomenal example of that. The other thing about it I like is that what it says about leadership in some senses, and that ultimately the people who clinch it are the smallest, least significant beings in the whole thing. So in strategy story, we've got a distinction. Last time I was in the States, in North America, actually, I was going to present some of this at Harvard. We've got this distinction between red squirrels and grey squirrels. So grey squirrels are quite big, quite territorially expansive, muscular squirrels. You know, red squirrels, we've got little indigenous squirrels here that are much smaller. They're exceptionally cute, but they're quite shy. And they keep themselves to themselves. This thing in Harvard, I was worried because there was grey squirrels everywhere in Harvard, and I was a bit scared of them. And I thought, this is a big sign, Donald. Don't mention red squirrels. Don't mention them. And I did. And everybody kind of liked it. But it was basically trying to say that leadership doesn't always belong to the big person with the sword or the expansive, aggressive machismo. You know, we've got to open ourselves up to the fact that there's loads of ways of doing things and loads of ways of leading. And I think the example that the Hobbits give in Lord of the Rings is a phenomenal example. They risk everything in their own humble way. There's a brilliant scene at the end of it when they bow, I think, to Aragorn and his queen. And they say to them, you bow to no one. And I like the kind of justice in that, because they're underdogs in a lot of ways, but they saved the day. When I heard they were going to make it, I thought, this is a step too far. There is absolutely no way they will ever do justice to the book. And I have to say, the people behind it, the director and the producers and all the special effects, it is a gobsmacking achievement. So as a piece of ambition and strategic stretch and leadership to the film industry, absolutely outstanding achievement. It's just gobsmacking what they changed the game, I think. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible achievement, that film. The other thing about it, so this is, we're getting a bit more philosophical and mystical here, but a great storyteller that I have been fortunate enough to meet, Martin Shaw, really challenged the idea that we are the writers of stories in a way. And he was talking about agency and how lessons are transmitted from, I think he used the term bone memory, how lessons are transmitted from generation to generation through the stories that we share. And that in some senses, these stories are agentic themselves. It's like they're trying to help us through our journeys in life by giving us guidance when we find ourselves in complex and challenging situations. These stories might be something to which we can refer and think, how would that person have dealt with this? Or what little lessons can I pull from that that could help me? And again, back to Joseph Campbell, the mythologist, I remember him saying that he worried for young people today because to some extent they had been stripped of the mythologies that we grew up with and the great stories. And that in this incredibly changeful world, they were kind of short of great stories to draw examples from. And I kind of put that together with what I understood was partly Tolkien's motivation, which was to recreate a mythology. And he's done that. I mean, I really think he's done that. I think so many people will be influenced unconsciously by what they've picked up from that film. A very powerful story, I think, in a lot of ways. Even to the point of, you know, there's an awful lot of stuff out there at the moment about artificial intelligence, the embodiment of a particular form of being. The whole film's about that. The whole film, Lord of the Rings, is about the embodiment of a particular form of energy. And we can see that happening now.
You know, Donald, you talk about Joseph Campbell, and I really love Joseph Campbell. I did a lot of my thesis research on him. And he talks a lot about stories are all different kinds of things that on your life path, they tell you where you are, not only in time, but your own personal history and your age. But one thing he said, ultimately, I keep on coming back to, and he said that, you know, everyone's going around thinking they're seeking a meaning for life. And he said that's not what he thinks people are seeking. And he thinks people are seeking the experience of being alive. And stories put you in touch with just that.
I think Joseph Campbell is going to be revered much more in the future than he is now. Absolutely incredible scholar. The point of being in this earth is not to suss out the meaning of life. It's just to live it. It's just, I think that's the same point in a way, in just slightly different words. And then you had this term, follow the bliss, which is not always going to be happy, you know, but go for it. You're only here once. Enjoy it and deal with it as it happens. Don't plan all the nasty surprises out of your life, because if you try and plan all the nasty surprises, you'll have inadvertently planned out all the good ones as well.
Donald, what is your third film?
Definitely my third film is Bad Times at the El Royale.
First time at the El Royale?
You have the option to stay in either California or Nevada.
I always wanted to stay in honeymoon suite, even though I'm not currently on my honeymoon.
So, talking about this idea of experience of being alive, what does this third movie say about the experience of being alive, Donald? I was so surprised by it. I haven't seen it yet, but I watched the trailer. I know Ed loves it. And it looks terrifying to me.
There's a few things that really strike me about it now. So one of the things that struck me about this film was how every shot in it is a work of art. I mean, it's just visually absolutely gobsmacking film. If you froze every single frame, you'd be going, wow. Visually, I think it's one of the most remarkable films I've ever seen. So the what is it about? It starts with like a group of about 5 or 6 or 7 people arriving in a hotel that straddles a state line. And there's some deep significance in the straddling of that state line, which I haven't quite unpacked yet. But then you gradually begin to get the story of each of these people who have arrived. And so the thing that's different about it is that it's not just one story. And I think this is really important in the organisational land that we inhabit. The idea of one story has to always go hand in hand with the fact that an organisation is a concept. I've never seen an organisation. What we've actually got are people. And every person has got their own story, their own biography, their own hopes, their own aspirations. And the job of real leadership is to somehow or other weave these individual stories into something meaningful in a way that works for everybody, where everybody feels that they're winning something out of it, I think. And this film kind of does that, although winning I'm really stretching it there, because at the end, most of them get killed. It's just that it's the artistry with which these individual stories are revealed and then brought to a cataclysmic conclusion at the end in the most melodramatic Shakespearean tragedy, really, at the end of it. It's just absolutely jaw-dropping. And every character is not what they seem. Every one of them has got a backstory. There are surprises round every corner. And then there's this mysterious process of observing them. So the hotel's kind of got a corridor in it where the management can go. And the management can set up cameras that film the people in their rooms for all kinds of purposes. So it's a really dark and beautiful, brilliant film.
It's a movie that I probably wouldn't tell people is one of my favorite movies, because it's one of the darkest. But it's there's a reality to it. It's really, to me, more of a horror movie than anything else. But it has a message. It has a message of, I think, redemption. And there are, not to give anything away, but there are a couple of characters who survive this montage of death and murder. And they're characters largely that represents goodness from beginning to end. Doesn't play games, doesn't cop out in any way. And she's a wonderful singer. And the closing scene is her singing on the stage, which is what she wanted. And the other one of the other people who survives is someone who at a different point was lost and was deceitful, but goes through the stuff and comes out of it in a good place. So to me, when I try to figure out, okay, what is this, the whole purpose here? I think it's, you know, again, be careful of the stories that you tell yourself. One of the ugly parts of this is a cult-like figure who convinces two sisters that their way to success and heaven, if you will, is by murdering others. And so there's like two paths. In some ways, it's almost one of my favorite books was Stephen King's The Stand, which is ultimately about good and evil. And Bad Times at the El Royale, to me, in many cases, is just completely black and white about there's a path you can take to do things wrong, and it will get you in a very ugly place. And then there's a path that you can take which will get you to a place where you want to be. And even if you're in the wrong place, you can make decisions that will, if you will, bless you to get you in a better kind of a place. But it's just a magnificent, engrossing movie that requires you to go through ugliness to get to a positive outcome.
Donald, you've chosen movies that are complete worlds, very different complete worlds, which I think is so interesting. The tones are so strong in these different movies. So what I want to know, if this movie has any indication of your feelings about the future, do you feel you're an optimist about where we're headed story-wise, maybe even AI-wise? Are you internally an optimist? Do you think humans have heroic qualities that will rise to any occasion?
Oof, that's a big question. Most people that know me would say that's probably one of my defining characteristics. I am the ultimate. In fact, I'm possibly verging on bonkers, because even in really bad situations, I can see good stuff coming out of them and hard things that have happened personally and all kinds of things. Ultimately, if we kind of put our ego to the side for a little while, you can see that they can be really developmental. You know, so yeah, I am an optimist, and I think that difficulties ultimately have got the possibility of turning into beauty. In actual fact, I think that's often what art is and what good films are. They show us how to do that. Even things like the climate crisis just now, which is in some senses, you know, it's like Armageddon's approaching. It's not about the climate, it's about us. if we started talking to each other and behaving more sensibly, there's a very optimistic future. But if we could just get there. I think that the one that scares me most at the moment, and this is more based on my my technical side is I'm a little bit more concerned, as many, many people are, this is highly unoriginal, about what might happen with AI, the internet, all that kind of thing. I think so. One of the my theoretical home is a body of theory called complexity theory, and basically what it says is that when you connect things up together, they develop emergent properties that are beyond the control of any of the elements. And so as soon as I saw the internet gaining its kind of foothold on planet Earth, you think, actually, so what we've got here is loads of elements connecting up together. It's exactly the same structure as a human brain in a way. It's loads of elements connecting up together. Is there any possibility that this thing could develop its own properties beyond any of the designers? And I think that still worries me a little bit, that we might be in the foothills of something quite beyond us. I mean, genuinely beyond us. I think we could be in the very beginning of an act two here in a story that might take us all by surprise, and not necessarily in a good way at the outset. So that's the biggest challenge to my optimism. But hopefully, see, the optimist is back. Hopefully, we will not let the tail wag the dog, and we've got to get back to the fundamental question. I think, why are we developing all this stuff? So we're pretty good at how, and we know what it is we're developing. I'm beginning to think we might have lost touch with why. What is this all for?
All these movies ultimately are about choices that are made or not made. Based on your face, I have not hit on anything. But
So Ed, just so as you know this, if I taste wine in a restaurant, the waiter usually takes a step backwards because he thinks I'm going to swing a punch or something. It's actually, and I'm not, it's just the way my face goes when I'm thinking. I think that ultimately they're about choice, and choice for what purpose, really. I suppose I've got a deep belief that we are all on a journey through life where we're presented with choices that will lead to redemption or otherwise. So are we going to get back to the pure being that we were born as and get our egos under control or not?
That's great. Yeah, all three movies are just totally about that.
They definitely are, actually. And I think the thing that sometimes these choices are difficult for other people. So one of the things that comes through in quite a lot of the films is that they all rock the social order where they are. Some of these choices, and I think that's the fundamental difficulty that most of us experience, and in actual fact, what most stories ultimately are about. So as you move on, sometimes, you know, like Bilbo and Sam, they have to leave the others behind, or they have to, you know, in the dead, she reveals something, you think, all right, so it's all changed. So there's always some kind of ripple goes through the social ordering of things when things are about to change. And I think that if we resist these choices, sometimes we can get into really painful territory. It's better to suffer the difficulty of the choice than end up languishing in some kind of stuckness.
It opens up new choices. It gets into the notion of we can create our own stories wherever we're at.
And just to harken back to, you were saying that an organization's actually just not one story, but it's a web of stories that are woven together, that a leader has to then create a monomyth that speaks to everybody in that organization, them to feel a part of it.
So Jessica, this is really important stuff, and it's very important for strategy story. Create and recreate a story. So people have to be able to continue to develop this story as a living thing. And that's where we differ from the stories that are written down, in that because it's spoken, it's continually on the move. And I think I heard a phrase from somebody a few years ago, which was, it stayed with me. I don't really know. It's got work to do, this phrase, on me. It hasn't done it yet, but I know it's kind of got work to do. And the phrase is the tyranny of narrative. So that just as plans can strangle new possibilities, so can the desire to force everything into some tidy, coherent narrative. And I think the thing about El Royale is it really makes that point. It really makes that point. Don't get too caught up in your idea of how to join up the dots, because it's just an idea. Even the idea of a story and a narrative, they're predicated on a particularly linear view of time. One of the things that kind of interests, troubles, challenges me most is how taken for granted our notions of time are when you're making these choices.
Well, speaking of, and I noticed the time, you still have two choices to make. Based on this journey we have gone together before our time runs out, you get a book and you get a snack before we send you to the moon. We'll do the snack first.
Yeah, I'd like to say something really posh, like smoked salmon or quail's eggs or caviar, that kind of thing. But I think if I was really hungry, probably the snack that would satisfy me most regularly is a packet of plain crisps. So long as they're real potatoes and not reconstituted potatoes, yeah, I don't really mind. So long as they're quite heavy, I don't want any low-fat, caffeine-free crisps. I want like proper, in-your-face, weigh-you-down crisps, yeah.
Donald, those are yours in an endless supply.
Right, so now I'm getting interested in going.
So yes, and then you do get a book if you would like to choose one.
Do you know what? This is a really interesting question, because I have to confess, this is a bad thing for at least part academic to say. I'm finding it quite difficult to read books at the minute. The book that I would take with me is Rilke's Book of Hours. Its subtitle, I think, is Love Letters to God. It's absolutely jaw-droppingly, mystically, powerfully, humbly stunning.
Wow.
The written word just doesn't get any better than that, in my view.
Oh, that's fabulous. A beautiful copy is yours. We'll make sure you have one of those like leather-bound ones with the beautiful gilt detail for you.
I'm not sure Rilke would be that impressed as he pictures me eating it with crisps falling all over it.
But you'd have a beautiful view looking back at Earth, so I'm sure he would be appreciating being read while doing that.
Yeah.
Donald, that's so great. Thank you so much. This has been an absolute joy having you. And the moon is lucky to have you. You're going to be making a substantial contribution.
Go for launch.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Roger, go.
I know what I'm watching tonight.
T-minus 15 seconds.
But preferably not alone.
10, 9.
Bye, Donald! Well, good luck,
thank
on
you.
The moon.
Thanks very much. Goodbye, everyone.
Enjoy
it's been
your
great
dresses.
Being on planet Earth. I'm going to meet some very interesting people up there, I know that. They're beings.
You're
beings.
Be
thank you.
Company.
Bye.
Safety, Christmas for us.
Thank you. I will. I probably won't.
Power and telemetry nominal. Vehicle supersonic.
Thank you for joining us. There's no good story unless there are people to enjoy the story. We'll see you at our next podcast, and if you have ideas, let us know.
Moon Snacks is sponsored by Highlands and Islands Enterprise and Light Dark Light, with hosts Jessica Fox and Ed Hoffman, and special guest Donald McLean. It was produced, edited, and with sound design by me, Ben Please.
Brought to you in partnership with Highlands and Islands Enterprise, the Economic and Community Development Agency for the North and West of Scotland. HIE.co.uk